Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I was out taking my walk after the meal. I was happy to see many people out there walking as well, walking off the full meal of the day, guaranteeing an alert, awake afternoon. Someone had mentioned that maybe the hot water wasn't available after the meal, and I hope it was for everybody who needs coffee and tea. I was thinking a little bit about how the retreat's been going for people, and listening to the different questions that have been coming up, and somehow started reflecting on a sort of a concept of pop science, probably. Maybe with a little basis in real science, but the whole right brain, left brain kind of way of looking at things. So, you know, as probably most of you know, the common usage of those words, and again, probably not very scientifically based, but left brain being, you know, the kind of a person who's a left brain person and, you know, tends to think and process and analyze and, you know, be fairly analytical. Oriented, word-oriented, speech-oriented, things like that. And the right-brain person, you know, is more, you know, what they say is more intuitive or, you know, less conceptual, but more, more intuitive or artistic or, you know, emotional maybe as well, sensitive, those kinds of things. So I was kind of thinking about that in relation to practice, and actually just wanted to do a little quick survey here. You know, I'm definitely a left brain. I was brought up left brain all the way, math awards and all that kind of stuff, and speech, verbal kinds of things. I write all the, you know, all the administrative type letters at the monastery and health insurance and, you know, visa applications and things like that. So that's kind of, so I'm a left brain person. How many people here are left brain people? Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Just getting a general survey here. Right brainers, people more intuitive? Yeah, okay. Yeah. maybe mixed, anybody who's a mixed brain? No brainers? We've got a pretty healthy mix here. Just thinking about some of the ways that we approach practice, and for this time anyway, this afternoon maybe, just to really encourage a little bit of movement into, you know, the more right brain kind of approach, not descending too far to get kind of lost in a swirling whirl of, you know, images and sleepiness and dullness and things like that, but just to kind of start to relax the conceptual process a bit. It's very easy to get caught in that if you tend towards left brain activity. So I noticed that there's, you know, a handful of people out and, you know, out here who are taking notes and listening very carefully and that kind of stuff. So put the notebooks away, put the pens down, and just kind of listen with your heart. And yeah, a lot of you know, what We've been talking about a number of different things, always coming back to the structure of the Four Noble Truths as the basis for our practice, and always needing to remember that we're starting from this basis of needing to acknowledge the first couple of noble truths in a very clear and honest way. We have to admit that there is unsatisfactoriness in our lives and the ways we've approached looking for happiness. We have to allow that in. We have to penetrate that. We can't sidestep that and move on to the other noble truths. The first noble truth comes first. Second noble truth also, we have to take an honest look at what it is that is at the root of that discontent. Even in the best of lives, when we've got all the material requisites we need, good relations, supportive circumstances, there is that fundamental underlying sense of something's not quite right. And we have to acknowledge that and look at the possible causes. As we're told in the teachings, the causes of looking for and seeking happiness in certain ways that provide some sort of temporary satisfaction, but do have this tendency to fade away and leave us wondering what next, whether it's in the world of the senses, the material world, or the world of our identity, how we see ourselves, how we become in this world, our roles, and also how we try and get rid of the unpleasant aspects of our life through withdrawal, avoidance, annihilation, in any ways that we can. Those are the ways that we look to find contentment and avoid suffering, and they work sometimes for short periods of time. So we have to be willing to look honestly at these first noble truths as a significant part of our path for long-term happiness. Part of the strategy also is learning other ways to find happiness within the realm of conditions that are a bit more long-lasting and a bit more settling and peaceful, and can be part of the path to really understanding and realizing the complete cessation of dukkha. And there are a lot of the teachings that we've been talking about so far in this retreat, Lungpa, Debbie, Ajahn Yanako, myself, all of us have been talking about ways to gladden the mind, soften the mind, as not only pleasant and uplifting qualities in and of themselves, but also that serve as a basis for actual realization of truth. They lead in the right direction. Even though they're part of the realm of conditions, they lead in the right direction towards the experience of the unconditioned. So we've talked about those in different ways. And I was thinking that, I kind of wanted to maybe talk a little bit about right concentration, because that's part of, the Noble Eightfold Path. That's one of the places where the Buddha really explicitly talks about the development of wholesome but longer-lasting, satisfying ways of attaining peacefulness and happiness, and that they're part of this process of finding pleasant experience that is not of the worldly nature, the unworldly sukha vedana, as Lungpa mentioned early on. So, you know, we pick up the practice and we do our readings and get to learn, well, what is this path of meditation and how will I be able to develop it in a way that I can, you know, realize some of this longer term sense of happiness, this more sustaining form of sukha vedana, of pleasant feeling, pleasant experience, because we need these experiences to nurture our practice. We need that to give us the strength and inspiration and energy and an alternative form of happiness, because we're being asked in some ways to really look at the typical ways that we've been trying to get it and to let it go. But we, in the meantime, we need to really have some kind of superior alternative. And so, you know, we turn to the teachings and teachers, and we have to be circumspect, because we have to watch how these particular teachings that we pick up and hear and learn about, how they affect us. A lot of the questions that have come up, or some of the questions that have come up in the Q&As that I've been listening to, have had tones of things like, am I doing this right? I've tried this and this, but it doesn't seem like I've got the right technique. Can you tell me what I'm doing wrong? What is it that, how should I be developing this particular mindfulness practice or this particular technique? And sometimes this even happens with some of the teachings from our tradition, that we hear many very inspiring stories of the senior disciples in our tradition, and the commitment that they've made, that the striving they've gone through, the kind of effort that they have put in day and night through over many years of striving towards the goal. And the words can be sometimes very strong. Don't soften. Don't let the defilements, overwhelm you. Get in there. Walk, sit. What's happening in your mind? 100% mindfulness all the time. And that can be, if you've got the right mind for that, that can be very inspiring if you tend towards kind of being easygoing and maybe towards a little bit of laxity and laziness, then strong words, strong images, inspiring examples like that can be very useful to get one motivated. I've also seen that sometimes backfire. I've known more than one monk who has held to those ideals very, very strongly, to the point of kind of ignoring what their own experience is telling them. Even after many, many years of practicing and striving to meet those expectations, those self-imposed expectations based on some idea of what they think is the only way or is the best way, I've seen people just collapse in the face of that. People disrobe over that kind of sense of having failed. So one has to know one's own mind and how to pick up these kinds of teachings and how to use them so that the mind, as Debbie was talking about yesterday, doesn't become too tight, that there needs to be this balance of inspiration and energy and commitment and effort. That's certainly there, and it's easy to lose that. And there needs to be a sense of relaxation and enjoyment and a sense of, really just settling into it and reaping some of the benefits from it without getting so tense and tight that we just lose the picture altogether. So you look, some of us have been practicing for many years and we know some of the literature around the, right concentration and it is defined in the scriptures oftentimes as the attainment of the four jhanas or a jhana kind of practices. And we learn the steps of what's involved in jhana practice, and we hear the terms. And we, put in our effort and strive, and sometimes, you walk away and you think, well, where's my piti? Where's my sukha? Everybody's talking about piti and sukha. what about me? Oftentimes that's a result of taking this kind of, as Lumpa was talking about this, in my words, this kind of linear left brain technique approach to it. If only I just get these particular factors lined up and get the body just right and get everything set up and take my object and can stick with that and deal with all the different things that come up and slowly come back and analyze, where it is that I need to go, then some magic will happen and I will experience rapturous bliss and pleasure and sink into, a very sublime state of concentration, with only minimal amounts of vitaka and vichara and then you fade a little bit and think, okay, well, now I need to get my vitaka back because I've lost that and I'm just wandering over here. So okay, what vitaka do I need to pull up? And okay, where's the piti? Is that coming up yet? Ekagata was at one point, so I need to really be, focused on this one point here. But is this vitaka now or is this vichara? and on it goes. Left brain. it's kind of no wonder that sometimes some of our teachers, as they brought the practice to the West, have kind of minimized that whole emphasis, even though it's, a clear description in the scriptures and talked about in many ways, and is an accurate portrayal of the development of samadhi, that the actual process of teaching that and emphasizing that and encouraging the development of practice, along those lines tends to be de-emphasized because of, the experience that, it can be really picked up in a way that is giving just the opposite effect. And just even the word, right, concentration, evokes sometimes the that same kind of sense of frustration and difficulty. The whole idea of, like, sit down and concentrate, you're losing track. and you get sort of this kind of image of your school teacher, telling you to sit down at your desk and concentrate, stop wandering around. And that's what concentration is. I remember that. I was just thinking about my fourth grade teacher, and actually my fourth grade teacher was very good. It was this fourth grade assignment. We had to memorize poetry. And I remember, you know, memorization was never something that was very easy for me, and poetry is a right brain thing. But we had to memorize these poems. And I remember, it's a really clear image of being at home in my room and knowing that I would have to stand up in front of the classroom and recite this poem the next day. And trying so hard to memorize this poem, and I just couldn't sit still. It's like I remember actually literally trying to memorize line by line as I was climbing up on my desk, jumping up onto the bed, moving to the chest of drawers, just like this body, you know, this 9-year-old body full of energy that didn't want to have anything to do with sitting still and concentrating. And just the absolute frustration. And that's kind of the image that comes up when I hear about how to concentrate the mind. So if there's that kind of association, we need to let go of that. That's not what it is. But that's what our old perceptions might tell us. So needing to find ways to reframe it and encourage us in developing settledness of mind as a longer term strategy for contentment. In an alternative way of approaching samadhi, settledness, sometimes kind of just setting aside the whole aspect of thinking about the various jhana factors, those kinds of things. And one of the things that is also clear in the scriptures in terms of the development of sama samadhi, and also is really clear in some of the factors that are talked about in relation to entering the stream. You know, there's all these debates that go on sometimes. It's like, you know, well, how much concentration do you need to enter the stream? Do you need to have jhana? Some people say, yes, you need to have jhana. Some people say, no, you don't. You know, then there's a whole thing of access concentration or neighborhood concentration or momentary concentration. Setting those things aside, one thing that I found more particularly useful for me is something that also I think is pretty clear from the scriptures, and that setting aside the debate of jhana and that kind of a thing, that one thing that is clearly useful is the abeyance of the five hindrances. Removal or relinquishing of the five hindrances as sort of a basis for sama samadhi. And I'm sure most of you have, you know, heard many talks and done your own readings and reflections on the different analogies for the five hindrances and starting to learn how to let go of these kinds of obstructions. So I won't go into a huge amount of detail, but just to say that I've found in my own sitting practice that reflecting on those has been very useful. And doing it in a way that brings up positive imagery. And this is where sometimes the use of words can be helpful, I find anyway. We can use words to think and analyze and categorize and keep things on a very high, you know, or very surface conceptual level. Or we can use words to help bring us down into some of the deeper layers, of the citta, the heart. So all the concepts and words, the verbal level, both thinking and talking, often takes place, on a very very surface level, but underneath that are all the affective aspects of citta, right brain kinds of things, like moods and emotions and inclinations and habits and perceptions and feelings, all kind of mixing and percolating in the layers underneath the concepts and the thinking. You know, they're feeding the concepts and the thinking, kind of bubbling and fermenting away to this, influencing this top layer, this foamy top layer of thoughts and ideas. But they are known on a much more affective level, below the level of verbal activity. And one can use words to point in that direction, to draw the attention to a deeper level. You just have to be, I find for myself anyway, I have to find the right words to use to help coax the mind into that more experiential layer of mind. And, you know, positive descriptors are very useful in that process. Kind of thinking about another kind of like an analogy. I was looking at a canister, a tin of green tea the other day, and like I think one of the lines along that was describing this particular tea was something like you know, overtones of coconut and pecan, you know, a hint of tangerine, and. Yeah, I was thinking, wow, you know, that's really taking green tea to a, you know, pretty exalted level. But that's what sells, you know, that's what attracts the mind. And, you know, the label doesn't say, a little bit better than mediocre, or, you know, free from bitterness. You know, it comes up with more positive terms. So, in a way, you know, I found that very useful in working with the hindrances and helping to settle the mind as well, taking a bit more of a proactive approach to helping coax the mind into ease, relaxation. You know, just even those words, ease, relaxation, you know, what does that feel like? Feels a little bit different than, you know, concentrated. So using words to invoke that sense of peacefulness. So in relation to the five hindrances, maybe just to talk about them a little bit, one by one, and while I'm talking about it, use this time just to not just think about it or hear the words, but just to allow yourself to see what kinds of feelings they may invoke inside yourself. Allow your mind to open and relax to a slightly deeper level than just the words. So it's it can be a meditation. In and of itself, just listening a bit. So the first hindrance, when we look at it, it's usually translated as sensual desire. And that's when the five senses, or the six senses actually as well, have this allure and captivation for us. We get lost in the world of sights, sounds, tastes, tactile sensations, smells, and our wish for satisfaction is bound up in these, and intellectual ideas, particularly on a retreat like this, where we've you know, kind of hone down the external stimulation. But the mind is still moved by those. They're very compelling. And this is, you know, talked about as the first hindrance, needing to deal with that so that one isn't so moved in that direction. The Buddha talks about this as one develops a sense of knowing how those move us and how not to be quite so moved by them through our experience, then as that eases off, there is a sense of relief. And he compares it to being free from debt. So that, you know, when we're under the influence of that particular one, we're in a sense owned by the sensory world. We're owned by the sights and sounds and tastes, and particularly the ideas and the thoughts and the plans and all the activities of the mind that are saying, come here, deal with me, you know, look at me, solve this problem. Then you'll feel better. You know, take care of this issue. Just settle this one last thing, and then everything will be quiet. Everything will be fine. Or you need a drink. You need something to eat, and then everything will be fine. Or listen to this piece of music. That'll relax you. That'll help everything settle. The compelling voices, all the leftover things from the workday. That are saying, you know, deal with me and then I promise you peace. So we learn to say, no, I don't think I need to do that anymore. And we say, you know, working on other ways of letting go of the desires and discontents of the world. Now's the time that I don't have to pay attention to those voices, even if it's just for this half an hour or whatever. I don't owe any more to you on that. You know, I've paid my debt for the day, I don't need to respond. One does not have this obligation anymore. One is debt free. To the realm of the senses. A good positive word that I use when considering this is independent. No obligation, independent. So just take that in. What does that feel like? Okay, I don't have to deal, I don't have to respond to these. I can be independent and under no obligation. How does that feel? The second hindrance, irritation, sometimes strong forms, anger, but more common probably for us, little irritations come up. And we work with those in different ways. And the analogy of when that abates is being recovering from an illness. So one is free from the fever of irritation, in a way. And the feelings that arise, the positive feelings that arise when that settles, are feelings of warmth or of gentleness, kindness. Spaciousness, being free from that illness, one has the opportunity to experience these, essentially these feelings of kindness, loving kindness, metta. But the words that are useful in pulling one into that sphere are what you need to cultivate to get below the idea, to get below the concept and into the experience. So for me, you know, people will come up with their own words, but for me, words like warmth, gentle, spacious, coming up with maybe an image that invokes, that evokes those kinds of feelings. So if you've got a sense of independence and warm, caring heart, moving on and looking at the next hindrance of sloth and torpor. Sometimes, if one develops a sublime sense of relaxation and caring and gentleness, it settles the mind. But if one isn't a little careful, then it might have a tendency towards just a little bit of dullness. Not even talking about, you know, full-out sloth and torpor, but just even a sense of subtle laxity. The mind isn't quite as sharp. It feels good, and it feels a whole lot better than it did before, but maybe there's a bit of fuzziness around the edges, you know, and if that's moved into, then it can cause the mind to sink a bit. So, invoking a little bit more energy as an antidote, or using words for me like clear, cool, fresh, light, visualizing light. Move it into the realm of experience using these kinds of descriptors. Alert. What does it feel like to be clear and fresh? Cobwebs are cleared out of the mind. Bright. Those are all words for me that evoke a certain feeling. So use those. Sometimes the mind gets a bit agitated, the fourth hindrance, restless. And, you know, words that seem to help settle that restlessness. And kind of induce a sense of peacefulness. Those are useful words to bring in. The Buddha used the analogy of being freed from slavery. The restless mind holds a lot of control over us. We almost sometimes have to, you know, obey the feeling of restlessness to get up and do something. So being freed from that sense of restlessness is like being freed from slavery. You are your own master now. Words like serenity, peace, stillness, quiet, images of a very clear, still, reflective pond of water, pool of water. No ripples across the surface. Discovering and finding that feeling inside of quiet, peace, using words and images to help. Doubt is the last hindrance. The Buddha compared doubt to being like wandering across a long expanse of desert. And the freedom from doubt is what it feels like when you see land or reach the other side, successfully cross the desert. That sense of bewilderment is gone, or that sense of confusion clears up, and there's that certainty. Ah, I see where I'm going. And what's the feeling that comes from that, you know? Sense of safety, a sense of security, sense of confidence. And when we set aside our doubt, oftentimes, you know, the doubts will come up in various ways, like, is this the right path? Am I doing the right thing? I've tried for so long. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe this isn't the right way. Maybe I should be exploring different kinds of spiritual paths. But if one looks at the qualities of unwholesomeness and wholesomeness, is this path one that leads to wholesome conditions? Even if I'm not experiencing all the things that I think I should, or that it's going, I'm not sure if it's going in the right direction. Is it leading in a wholesome direction? Is what the path is asking me to do, to consider, to engage in, to practice, are they things that result, at least theoretically, in less suffering for myself, for others? Will it conceivably, possibly lead to peace, happiness, tranquility? Is it encouraging the development of these kinds of skillful, wholesome things? And if you can say, yeah, even though I'm not quite sure where I'm at on that path, that's where this path goes, then you can say, okay, well, it doesn't matter where I'm at. I know this path leads there. I can have the confidence to just keep doing it. So, a sense of security, safety, confidence, freedom from doubt. So just going back through those again, using the words if they're helpful. Look at your experience right now, the breathing in, the breathing out. Watching the interior landscape of the mind below the level of words, more at the level of feeling. Think independent of the senses, independence, no need to respond to those calls. It's okay to just stay quiet, to watch. Watch the breathing, setting aside those pulls, independent, warm, caring, gentle. What does that feel like? Clear, bright, still, calm, peaceful, energized. Secure, confident. Can you feel all of those mixed with each other? All these qualities of mind present in this moment. What does the mind want to do? At that point, it just wants to settle. It just wants to be with something simple. Doesn't have anywhere else it feels like it needs to be. So it can just be with the breathing. Or the body. Just experience that for a minute or two. a moment or two free from the hindrances. Even if you're not quite there, just develop it as a perception, as a possibility. So we can work on setting aside, relaxing, the whole goal orientation, techniques, striving, attainment, and just relax into, you know, what is possible. Developing skillful perceptions, ones that work. You know, and maybe it's not this particular set or these particular images, but there are ways to work with the mind to encourage it in a positive way. And it's up to every one of us to try and find out the way that works in our particular condition. Because it's from this kind of ease of mind, this relative freedom from hindrances, that we can start to even explore more deeply the nature of our experience, the different aspects of letting insight come upon us. Again, as Lumpal was saying earlier today, you know, we don't have to force it. We can't force these things. We can't force insight. We have to just allow the space to open where the natural reflections in our mind will bear some fruit in terms of insight. And it works together with this sense of settling, calming, and enjoyment. And it gives us an alternative to how we usually try and seek that pleasant experience. And that's really important in the long run as well. If we don't have some sort of sense of refuge in the realm of conditions, then it's just all too easy to get sucked into the old ways of finding more temporary forms of satisfaction. So this is the opportunity that we have on retreat to be able to settle into that. We're more than halfway through, two-thirds of the way through, and just encouraging people to continue using the opportunity of space and time and quiet and solitude and reflection to develop these states of mind. So I'll leave it there for now.